one thing I have learned in speaking with experts, big and small, famous and unknown, is this. It's the little actions that matter. The little things that knit us together. The small decisions that you make add up. One little positive action in an informed direction can help propel our world, the big global one and the small one that surrounds you every day. This is One Bite is Everything, the podcast that helps you have a big impact on your health, community, and the environment with tiny informed choices. I am your host, Dana DePrima. Today, we start small in the ocean off the coast of Virginia in Gloucester's Mobjack Bay with Sarah Matheson Harris, an unwitting oyster farmer whose unexpected life turn thrust her into a business centered around small protein-rich mollusks dangling from underwater trellises and making their way to tables by the dozen. Matheson Oyster Company is female-owned and family-run and is dedicated to sustainable production. All of these little things are at the core of what they do, and they add up. Lest you think small mollusks mean small business, let me give you some context before we get started. Globally, the oyster market is worth about $111 billion, and by 2030, it's projected to hit $143 billion, with an annual growth rate of around 3.5%. This growth is driven by rising demand in both the food service and retail sectors, and by advancements in transportation and distribution that make fresh oysters more accessible nationwide. Virginia is a top contender on the East Coast when it comes to oysters, and the numbers back it up. In the 2022-2023 season, the state hit a 35-year high with around 700,000 bushels harvested. A bushel has approximately 100 oysters in it, by the way. Each little oyster packs a protein punch that is good for you and filters ocean waters in a sustainable net zero process. That's a lot of power for one little mollusk. But there's more to the story. This is a family story, a legacy, and an investment in a time-honored community that matters. Let's dive in.
I grew up here in Gloucester, Virginia, right on the water. Actually, the house I grew up in was originally owned by my grandparents, and then my parents purchased it from them. My dad was an architect, and so his thumbprints are all over the property and house. And just the very candid truth that sometimes I like kind of gloss over sometimes, what I'll talk about with you is that my parents both got really sick in 2017. I'm an only child, and life got really flipped on its head in just a not great way. And so I ended up going through the passing of both of my parents within a month of each other. They both passed away 1 month apart. And so going through that, much of a change shakes you a little bit. And you're just like, oh my God, what now? Aside from all the emotional things going on, I was also left to deal with, I was the executor for both of them. I had to just, at 25, I had to decide what to do with these two people's lives. My dad actually would garden oysters as a hobby when he was in retirement. So I always connected that with him. And when my mom was first sick, we used to all joke that we would do oysters together just to give him that purpose too. And so then that felt like a very natural way for us to continue that legacy and continue the work towards what was really emotionally fulfilling for us. And so we were going to start a very small hobby farm right off the end of our dock. Very small. I was going to keep my job in advertising. It was going to be just a teeny little thing. But life spirals and I think puts you on the path that's ultimately right. We ended up finding an off-market sale of a very old, grungy trucking depot that was part of a working waterfront, because these things are impossible to find. Because working waterfronts, you obviously have to be right on the water. And so if something's not existing, it's near impossible to be able to build that because of the RPA buffer now. So we had found one section of one, an old one, and we ended up just pouring everything into it as far as just our energy, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. Took 2 years to renovate. And at the same time, we went after some state permits for how we wanted to grow the oysters, which is more topwater grown oyster. That's the type of oyster that I wanted to put my family name to. We decided to name the company Matheson Oyster Company, which is my maiden name. It's funny, when anyone addresses us, they assume it's my husband and his brother. And so they call them Eric and Corey Matheson. And I'm like, no, it's actually my name. I'm the sole owner. And we were able to receive a permit from the state. That's extremely rare in Virginia. We're actually, at that point, we were only the third farm in Virginia to receive this type of growing permit. And we're the only ones to grow this way completely on our farm. This was back in October 2021. Fast forward, we started selling oysters because they have a long inventory carry time. They take about 15 to 18 months to grow. So we started selling by fall 2022. And then now here we are. We're actually looking to expand to a second working waterfront to grow our footprint. So it's more of a campus feel because we're expanding so much. We now have two farms, and our second farm, I want to say, I think it's the largest of its type on the entire East Coast, that permit.
So you said that you grow them in a particular way that's different than others. Can you compare for me what you do versus how other oyster farmers do it?
So I think the best way to start is to look at traditional fisheries versus aquaculture. Traditional fisheries are the watermen that you really see old-timey photos of at a brewery where they're going out in these large boats and they have the net and the rakes and they're going down and they're raking up natural oyster reefs found on public grounds. So that's traditional fishery. And so those are called wilds or bottom culture. Whereas aquaculture, that is the intentional farming and replenishment of triploid oysters, which are non-reproductive. Sometimes aquaculture might do diploids, which are reproductive, but typically it's triploids because triploids can grow better in that farmed environment. So aquaculture is when a farmer takes seed. So that's a spat, but we call them seed, puts it into their farmed gear, tends to it several months of husbandry practices, and then ultimately harvests that out of the gear, takes it to market, and then replenishes that same gear with new seed. And so it's cyclical replenishment of those oysters. That's aquaculture. So we work within aquaculture, and the more standard method within that are bottom cages, which I can only speak to Virginia because everything is really sort of by state. The leading innovators for the oyster industry across the world are Australia, France, and then Prince Edward Island. Those are the places where you really look to see industry and to see innovation. And so this comes from Australia. And the reason that this was created in Australia in the 90s was that up until this point in the oyster industry, they relied on a lot of migrant workers who would just come through seasonally backpacking through Australia. And they relied on that for labor. But at some point in the 90s, that started to dry up. They weren't able to source as much seasonal labor. And so they developed a system that was much less labor intensive. I describe it visually. It kind of looks like an underwater vineyard, if you can imagine that. So if you're like thinking of a vineyard, you're thinking of the little tree and you're thinking that it's held up by cable on PVCs or post or something. And that's basically what this is. So say right now it's winter, it's cold, we might get a bad storm. We want them low because they're really hibernating right now. They're not growing. So we want them in the water. We want them covered. We want them safe. But come spring, when there's a lot more algae in the water, we actually might desiccate them. They are intertidal species, so they can absolutely live outside of the water from some period of times. And they don't mind some sun. It's actually great for them. So we'll actually raise them out of the water and right into that brute wave action that's coming by. And so the waves that come by naturally tumble the oysters, and the natural tumbling gives them a thicker shell. So when a chef might shuck them, it won't break on them. It gives them a deep cup, so full meat content. And then usually just a healthier, better oyster, full glycogen, everything like that. So it creates a wonderful oyster, really nice shell as well, great meat, like I'm saying. But those permits are pretty difficult to find. We work out of a historic waterman area. And so I think that's why we are pretty successful. Whereas I know a lot of companies, they're limited in where they can try to find grounds. And so it might be in a more public facing area. And that's when you can sometimes run into more difficulties with permitting because they sit above the water. You can see it all. You can see this farm. And so some people might not like that. Some people might consider it a navigational issue. Whatever it may be, it can be difficult to obtain these permits in the States.
And you think because you're in a historical building, on a historical site that you had an advantage or sort of a marketing in for them in giving them?
I think it's we stayed in our lane. I think it was that. I will say our first permit is a bit more exposed. So our first permit that we received, and I call it the boot camp farm. It is really brutal. Like it is sometimes very difficult to work. It is hard to manage a boat because there is no landmass between that farm and the Chesapeake Bay and really the Atlantic. You get very strong currents and it produces a wonderful oyster, but it can be really tough to manage. And so that farm is more exposed. It's a bit more in the main navigable area of the Mahjong Bay, which is where we farm. Frankly, I think partly we got lucky with that. I think that we were really, we take a lot of pride in filing very tight and well thought out, well executed permits. And our goal is to always work with the governing bodies to make their lives easier. They're up against a lot. And so whatever we can do to help the permitting process along and just make everyone's life easier and tick as many boxes as we can, I think that helps us. And so frankly, I think we got in at a good time. That was a great permit to receive. But the second one, that's a very large permit that if we were to build out the entire permit, it would give us around 11 million oysters a year, which is very large.
And how many are you producing now with the first farm?
The capacity of the first farm is around 2 million, I would say.
So that's a huge expansion.
Yeah, like I think it's the biggest on the East Coast. There's some big ones in the Gulf, but it's a pretty large permit. And that one is a bit more tucked back. It's still exposed to the wave action that we want and the wind directions that we want and the water quality that we want and the depths. But it is a bit more closely hugging this waterman area. There's an area in this town called, it's colloquially called Guinea. And that is where the working watermen are. That's very much this area. It's a really interesting historic area. Actually, a lot of linguists study this area because there's a certain dialect that people have here. And it's said that it was developed over time from shouting on the water back and forth to boats to communicate.
If you ever find yourself in this part of Virginia, you'll know you've met a waterman also known as a Guineaman because their accents are so incredibly unique. Their fast-paced dialect, reminiscent of Cockney English, can pose a challenge even for locals. Words blend together rapidly, resembling the cadence of an auctioneer's call.
So it is a very close-knit insular community of this is the historic purpose of this area. And so this is where our larger farm is. So I think that also made it easier for the governing bodies to allow and permit, because again, I think we were staying in our lane as far as working within aquaculture and oysters and in an area that no one was directly opposing that lived here.
And that area that you're talking about with, I'm just imagining all of the big personalities that are there on the water. What's their impression of a young woman running a really big oyster farm down there?
I have never gotten any flack. I've never had anyone be rude to me down here ever. Everyone's been really kind, actually. And I think that's because, number one, my brother-in-law is the captain. He's the one who drives the boats. He's our farm manager. And I think he has set a really good groundwork on connecting with a lot of people down here. He's the one that people see the most because he's out on the boat or putting the boat in, everything like that. And I also think there's a level of respect that we're also working a very physical job. And it's not like we were these millennials coming in and creating, I don't know, some warehouse selling candles or something like that. Like something really random for down here. I think there's a mutual level of respect that we're all working towards the same thing, which is we're working the water. We're working this natural resource. We all are doing it for a reason that we love it. We're all comfortable in this way of life. And ultimately, everyone knows that you've got to have an appreciation of these natural resources and really Mother Nature working out here. So there's that level of general respect I think everyone has down here for each other.
Tell me what it's like to farm oysters. Like, what's the process? You mentioned you're up against the currents, but give me the full picture.
Oh, yeah. Like, we're not in control. I want to make that very clear. Mother Nature is the one setting the tone each and every day. You can have a plan for the week and then the winds are like 30 knots and you're like, nope, it's not happening. So you have to be very agile, I think, with your plans and your farming. But in general, the steps are we purchase our seed from a hatchery and we purchase it at 2 millimeter size, which kind of looks like quinoa. It's like quinoa size. So it's funny, we'll purchase maybe 500,000 or 1 million at a time. So we'll obtain those usually in April, sometime around spring when the algae is back in the water. And so we plant those in, yep. We do not have an upweller or some of those systems where it's a controlled tank on land that you're building and fostering. We use what are called spat socks. And so it's, we use those cylinder shaped baskets I said. So they're all mesh and the mesh sizes are different depending on the diameter of the oyster that you're putting in. Cause you obviously don't want to put oysters in that could fall out, but you want the holes to be big enough that enough algae can get in and the oysters can feed and grow. So when they're really small, that 2 millimeter size, it's almost like a pantyhose kind of looking thing that you put in. It's a spat sock. Like it's just this mesh insert that you put in the basket. And so like they definitely can't get out. And then as they grow, especially when they're smaller, you have to manage them quite often. You're pulling them out, maybe hosing down the baskets, you're pulling them out to split. And so splits and grades are when you are splitting the density of the oysters in the bag. So if you can imagine, say oysters kind of mid life cycle, just hypothetical number, say there are 500 in a basket and they fill up in the basket where you want them to at that size when you put them in. But maybe a month later during the growing season, they've grown quite considerably. And so you always want to manage the blank space, the white space in a basket. So they have that area to tumble and feed. And so then you have to split that density. So say it was originally 500, we're taking it out a couple of weeks later and splitting it down to 250. So then one basket becomes two baskets. And so that's happening throughout the entire life cycle of the oyster.
When you're out with the baskets on the lines on your sea trellis, are you in a boat? Are you standing in the water?
Actually, in the water. So that is also a disadvantage. I think a lot of people see to this is that you have to get in the water throughout the entire year. We are in wetsuits right now in the water. And then in the summer, I enforce a pretty strict dress code for sun protection. So we're in sun shirts and sun pants in the summer. I mean, we go out and by boat and then we jump in.
And how far is the farm off land? Is it attached to land or is it just out in the water?
No, you want it to be a bit more out in the water. As far as where you can place farms, it needs to be in accordance with the Division of Shellfish Sanitation, where they say low bacteria count is. And so oftentimes the water right up against shore might not be as good of a growing area because you're having runoff or things like that or boat traffic. Whereas bit more out, you're getting better wave action, you're getting better depths, you're getting better salinity and healthier water often. So the original farm that we permitted, we still use, it's just we use it for middle life cycle now, but that's about a 15 minute boat ride maybe at tops, probably a little less from our facility. But the new farm, which is another reason we permitted this, I literally have a time check here. Yesterday they started harvest at 3:01 p.m. on the farm. And they probably only harvested like 5,000 and they landed at 3:19.
19 minutes?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Our goal is to basically beat any possible record that DDH has ever seen. Also, you want to get them in a cooler as fast as possible because, so Vibrio is a bacteria in the water. You cannot prevent it. It is in the water on the East Coast, at least. And it is activated or awakened when it's warm. And so in the summer, we actually have harvesting curfews that from the start of harvest to cooler, we only have 2 hours. And then we have 5 hours to get any oyster to below 50 degrees. No, 55, but shipping has to be 50. And so the faster you can get them in the cooler, like the better, the safer it is for the consumer.
Talk to me about your customers. Like, where are these oysters going?
So I'll first tell you a bit about the brands that we offer. The main oyster that we grow and sell, I've branded to be called Wavelengths. And that's a play on the natural wave action that we use to tumble the oysters. But it's also a play on that. Everything that we try to implement as a company, we look for the most eco-friendly or sustainable way to do it first and just try to adhere to that as best as can. So for example, the bags that we bring to retail are biodegradable out of a beech nut wood. So they're not plastic. It's a less direct play onto the wavelength that we're on of just trying to be as environmentally friendly as possible. So those are our signature 3 to 3.5 inch oysters that you often would see at like a raw bar. But we had some demand for larger oysters, and we had this demand, but we hadn't created the product yet. However, last year, last spring, some of our cables started snapping on the farm. They were sold to us as tsunami rated, but apparently not for the Chesapeake Bay. So we had over 40 cables break throughout the spring last year. And so what that created, that we didn't lose baskets, but what happened was that everything was down in the water. Everything fed, we couldn't raise the lines. So they were feeding and feeding and feeding. And all of a sudden we had these like monster Godzilla oysters. And we're like, oh my God, what do we do? Like, it would be so much profit loss if we just dumped them, or even taking them to a shuck house. Like, you get a lot less margin for that. And so instead I created a brand for them, and I branded them as Bonfires. So those are our roaster line. And so we now sell roasters, and we turned a problem into a solution. And the funny thing is that they became really successful. So we actually now have to keep this line going and just create and section off part of the farm for these larger oysters, because they were so successful in the market. But the customers that we sell to, we are in a really easy area transport wise in Virginia. Virginia has the infrastructure for the oyster industry. It's where the most oysters are grown and sold in the entire United States. It's easy for us to get around the places. So our largest market is, we chose to do direct to retail in our main area, which is a little bit of Williamsburg, mostly in Richmond and DC, kind of around DC. So we have a driver who will drive directly to the restaurants, drop them off once a week in each city. And I'm working directly with the chefs to create those relationships and that account management. And that accounts for 63% of our business. And the reason we decided to do that for our Mid-Atlantic market is because, number one, you do capture a higher margin. We cut out any possible middleman. Number two, we could easily drive it ourselves. It's not a big deal. And I actually was able to obtain a cold storage loan from my local Farm Bureau agency last year. It's really meant for coolers, but I convinced them that a cool truck would count. So we were able to close on that and get a Mercedes Sprinter van last year. So we have that. And then number three, I have full control with how we talk about our product, my relationships with the chefs. I get immediate feedback. Again, no middleman. So that was really important for us for our Mid-Atlantic home region. And so it's also awesome. Like, I'm working with all these really cool chefs and becoming friends with these chefs in our area. So that's been really fun.
Tell me a little bit about the feedback. I love this idea of this farmer to chef feedback loop.
I mean, it's good and bad. It's helpful. Like, one time, my husband Eric and I were on vacation, finally took a late honeymoon, like 7 years later, went to Italy. And then a chef was like, these aren't the size oysters I normally like. And we're like, oh, sorry, like, we weren't there. We'll tell our team, we'll set that out. So I'll get texts like that sometimes. Doesn't happen often, luckily. Or it is just like growing volume. There's a restaurant that's reopening from renovation next week, and I was able to just jump on the phone with the chef, and we were able to negotiate a better delivery time for his restaurant reopening. He didn't realize we also sold roasters, so now we're able to provide that. I was pitching him maybe even putting on an oyster martini on the menu. So it's that really great fluid conversation that's a lot of fun with chefs too, of just bouncing around different ideas. Another thing that's really helpful of working directly with restaurants is that it's ultimately the waiter that's selling your product at the end of the day. And so I provide every chef that I work with an information packet that I encourage them to share with their wait staff or print. And it has our salinity, the brand names, a little bit about our story. And so that at least gives the wait staff that education that if they want to pull from, they can. Because the more information, the correct information I can give the people actually selling the oysters, the better. Because usually, a lot of times, customers will go to restaurants and ask about what you have if it's not printed on the menu. Like, what oysters do you have? Tell me about them. And you want to make sure that person can actually speak to it correctly.
Is the woman-owned farm a selling point at the retail perspective?
Yeah, I think so. I think it does help, because I know a lot of chefs and wait staff who take pride in saying that. I also had someone just contact me, complete cold call, that they saw our name on a list. And because it was woman-owned, we were the ones that they called. of like out of 20. And I'm like, and they were like, we want to buy. I'm like, do you want a sample? Like, have you had the oysters? And I'm like, I know you'll like them. Like, they're great oysters. And they were like, yeah, send me a sample, but like, I'm going to put you on our menu.
And so are these restaurants saying these are Matheson oysters?
We ask them to, because then that's the best identifier for us. But a lot, I'm fine if they just do the brand name wavelengths, particularly if it's a oyster bar setting, that's what will happen. But it's always really great for us if we're printed on a menu, which does happen occasionally. Mm-hmm. But I also understand that other places that might cycle oysters, depending on availability or interest by the chef, that it might just read Virginia oysters or something like that. But my preference is to say Matheson oysters.
Let me go back to the oyster for a second, because when you were talking about growing them, you're looking for certain attributes in an oyster. Give me some of the thinking behind all of this, like the body of the oyster.
Well, at the very minimum, if a chef is paying a premium price for an oyster, which oftentimes ours are, we want to provide the full product, which is like a good source of meat. The not fun thing for a chef would be to pay a premium product and you're getting an oyster that's very thin, doesn't have a lot of meat to it. Because you're paying for that. And maybe different regions prefer different size oysters. For example, up north, they prefer smaller oysters, but you still want a fully developed oyster. So we don't like to send immature oysters to market. That's when they haven't really reached that full growth cycle. And some are small, but still fully grown. We really try to only send something that we're proud of. But ultimately, at the minimum, you should provide a clean shell, something that's easily plateable, because sometimes you can get growth, you can get spat set or barnacles, and that's going to happen. It's a little difficult for a farmer to truly say that's never going to happen. But I do try to at least always provide an oyster that can be set on a plate and well presented and is clean, full size that person wants, and as much meat as you reasonably can provide as well. And again, the thick shell is really important, because the way I often sell it when I go on sales calls is that they'll say, well, I can get an oyster nearly half the price. And I'm saying, well, how many are you going through and breaking out of a 100-count bag? And they're like, well, I'm breaking every other one. So it's like, all right, well, you're paying X price, but you're only getting 50, whereas you can pay our price and get 99 probably.
The tougher shells, and that really develops in the tumbling.
It does. Yeah. And the exposure too, the sun exposure helps, the air exposure. It kind of puts them in fight or flight mode a little bit. And so they grow a lot of meat and grow a thick shell.
Now, farm number one and farm number two together have the ultimate capacity with the permits that you have for 11 million oysters a year.
Yes. Which,
are you going that big so soon, or are you going to phase in?
Oh, you have to phase in. I mean, equipment purchases alone, labor for install. We've actually spent all of our winter really installing the second farm, because we got that permit in. We literally got that permit granted, I'm not kidding you, the day we drove our baby home from the hospital. And so, and that was also the time the lines were breaking at the other farm. We were selling so much. And so we're like, all right, we just need to, like, middle of winter, pretty dead, slowest months for restaurant too. We're like, all right, we just need to like take a little time and focus a lot of our effort on building. So we've been doing that. And also winter has more extended tides. So really low lows and longer lows. And that's what we need to get in the water to build that. So that's what we've been doing now. So building out the farm capacity takes time.
I want to talk a little bit about the environmental component. Obviously, you guys have a wavelength that you're on that is, you know, you're talking about sustainability. And explain to me, just from Mother Nature's perspective on the oyster, what they do naturally.
Oysters are filter feeders, which mean that they can filter the water that they're in. So it's best to say that they clear the water. The water is already clean. If the water wasn't clean, we wouldn't be allowed to grow oysters in it and serve them. So it's clearing the water. You can put oysters in the water and they will work through that nitrogen and phosphorus that's in the water from runoff and kind of filter out that nitrogen and phosphorus, and it'll fall to the bottom of the water. And so it's creating a higher oxygen content for other species. So what you don't want to happen is eutrophication, which is when excess nitrogen and phosphorus are in the water and it creates algae blooms, and that clouds the water and it creates a low oxygen content and other species cannot thrive, or any species really. So oysters combat that in an area because they're working through and clearing this pasture and creating clearer water. And so it automatically creates a better environment for any species living in that same water environment. They're really incredible, frankly. Like, oysters are awesome. They're, I think, probably one of the only net positive farming practices because there's no potable water, there's no feed, everything's already in the water. So you're not having to add anything to the water to create that. If you're looking at the actual protein you get from consuming it, it's also incredible. It's very high protein and extremely low carbon footprint for that. And so it really, I think, is a phenomenal source for protein, especially when you're looking at the future of 20 years down the line, what are people going to be eating and what gets you really the most bang for your buck environmentally? And oysters are great for that. So really, more oysters in the water are better. And that's why aquaculture, I really hope, gets even more and more embraced by the public, because the public just has to give permission. They have to just be okay with these permits, because aquaculture, like I said, we're consistently replenishing our baskets and consistently replenishing oysters. When we sell an oyster, we plant more. And so we're always putting in oysters, and the public is able to receive these benefits, these restoration benefits, just from these private aquaculture companies investing in the water. Otherwise, they would have to use taxpayer dollars to put towards these restoration efforts. An adult oyster can filter 50 gallons of water a day. So if you think that I have a couple million out there, imagine that, like, per day, what's happening. Oyster farms also create a habitat for other species. So like little crabs, bait fish, things like that. It provides that structure that wouldn't be there normally in that water for other smaller little critters to thrive. And then that actually even attracts larger sea animals. So we have a ton of fish out there. Anglers and recreational fishermen totally benefit from oyster farms. We see so many people out fishing around our farms during the summer because they know that they're probably going to find stripers or something out there.
What is the hatchery business like?
Actually, every oyster on the East Coast starts 10 minutes down the road from us at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. And that's where they're creating the brood stock that then hatcheries take a lot, like oftentimes, I would say, and create the oysters from. So pretty much every oyster that we're likely eating on the East Coast started 10 minutes from where we are.
So we've talked about some of the challenges that you face. What other kind of challenges do you see?
I alluded to this and touched on it. I'm not saying just us, but aquaculture, a lot of the times, misinformed or misguided public is a huge issue for a lot of companies. I've known so many companies that look to expand, need to expand, have the market to expand, but there's misinformation out there as far as what actually happens, what an oyster farm looks like, the benefits it brings. People conflate disadvantages. Like, I tuned in recently to a public forum where a farmer similar age to me was trying to expand their farm. They absolutely have the need to and market for it. And there were several people coming out and speaking misinformation. And that person can't jump up and say that's wrong. They can say that during their portion. But when you're having 20 people in a community say one thing, because that's what they're hearing, versus someone actually working in the industry, a lot of the times the permit process is not going to favor the farmer, unfortunately. For example, when we were trying to start this new farm, we had someone even outside of the community, they were still a Virginia citizen, but they're outside of the community, submit public protest. And they had said that our farm was going to attract enough birds to want to stand on the gear that we would pollute the entire Chesapeake Bay. That is not going to happen, clearly. That is a gross exaggeration. However, because of that, we had to put stipulations into our permit. And we're going to have to purchase additional bird attractors, even though our gear and swings in the water, birds can't balance on that, really. So it's tough. And we've had people blow up Facebook groups. We've heard about sharing misinformation about permits in our farm and things like that. And so if someone plants that seed, it can just spin out of control from there. It's a snowball effect. And so that's why I'm trying to place such a high importance on the public understanding the benefits that come from private aquaculture. And again, you would have to use taxpayer dollars to get those same benefits otherwise. So misinformation and a lack of buy-in from the public is a huge issue.
when people are speaking out against aquaculture, are they conflating oyster farming and farmed fish and other things in the water?
We often hear, like, with fish, I think the public is geared towards thinking that wild caught is better. And so I've had a lot of people think that with aquaculture, and I have in the industry, we all have to explain the difference between wild caught and aquaculture. Again, I'm not trying to speak ill of that traditional wild caught, but it's more of just informing about the benefits that aquaculture brings, that it's not a bad thing, because people can sometimes associate farmed oysters with farmed fish, and people are geared to think bad.
There's another community element of Matheson Oyster Company that you want to know about, one you probably didn't think a little oyster could impact.
Workforce development is really important for this industry, getting more people interested and involved with aquaculture. For example, the cultural benefits of, like I said, we're working in a historic waterman community, and you see a lot of that traditional waterman culture disappearing for different reasons, climate change, or maybe it's a family business and the son doesn't want to do it that way. Aquaculture provides a different source of income and way of life in these communities that, again, private companies are investing in these communities. So that's really helpful. But getting more and more people in younger generations interested in getting involved in this is only going to help. And also a more diverse workforce. A good friend of mine started Minorities in Aquaculture because she saw that gap of encouraging young minority women to get involved in aquaculture. And unfortunately, it is an industry largely dominated by, frankly, older white men. And so anything other than that is diverse. And the more voices, more experience, more points of view that come to this industry, the better, and the better it's going to flourish in the future. So we participate in an internship program during the summer that was funded by Go Virginia Region 6, and it was created by Virginia Tech and Rappahannock Community College in tandem, where they work with local high schools to encourage them to intern at different aquaculture companies in Virginia. And so we're entering our second year in that. Just, that's a great workforce development program. We're going to be opening up more internships this summer as well for younger people. So just encouraging the next generation to get involved in this, because, for example, if you look at historic working waterfront, studies have shown that if you no longer use it for that first intended use, it is more than likely going to fall into dilapidation and misuse and never come back online. And that's a huge cultural aspect for these water communities that I think should be preserved.
Any special message for non-farmers that you really want them to know, besides eat a lot of oysters?
Yeah, definitely eat a lot of oysters, because like I said, oysters are a great source of sustainable protein and the restoration benefits that more oysters in the water bring. But I think the most important thing is just getting more people educated and interested in it from different backgrounds, and just sharing that and showing it as a possible professional avenue. I would have never thought it was if, frankly, life hadn't tossed me around a little bit and put me on this path. In no way, shape, or form did I grow up thinking, even living in a waterman community, did I ever grow up thinking that I could ever work on the water, because I only saw like crabbers or dead rises and things like that. I didn't see a woman owning an oyster company with a marketing background who manages sales and relationships and manages a team and going from there. Like, I didn't see that. So the more opportunities that we can showcase, I think the better.
How do you like your oysters?
I like mine with lime juice and hot sauce, actually, which is not a normal way. And that came about when I was first dating my husband. My dad would throw Boxing Day oyster roasts where the oysters he would garden. He would pull them up. We had this old colonial grill that's randomly on our property. We don't really know the story of it, but we would do a big oyster roast and steam oysters. And one year we forgot to buy lemons, but we happened to buy limes. Had to have those. And so I really like sour stuff. And so we put them on, had a little hot sauce, and I loved it. So raw or steamed, I really like it with lime juice and hot sauce. And it pairs really well with a hazy beer, which I also really like. So that's probably my favorite way.
Oysters are a powerful protein with a sustainable future, using a net zero process, and have the added benefit of perpetuating waterman communities that might otherwise disappear. Matheson Oyster Company, female owned and savvy, is pushing ahead with two oyster farms and leading the East Coast in roasters and on restaurant menus. Marketing is an important part of the business with chefs, with oyster eaters, and with communities who need to understand how the business works in order to support its infrastructure through permits. 2017 was a particularly rough year for Sarah, losing both parents and stepping on a new path to both honor them and to pioneer a business she never thought she'd be in. You just never know what's going to happen and how life might toss you around. What's important is what you make of it. How you look at the ups and the downs is critical. You can take one bite in a new direction, an oyster direction, and that bite can be everything. Thanks for being here with us today. Sarah's story is an important one, both personally and also to understand the elements of this growing business, its opportunities and the impacts it can have on your diet, the health of the water and ecosystem it operates in, and historic and new communities it supports. Two things. If you like this episode, and I'm pretty sure you did because you're still here with me, write a review on Apple Podcasts. Or, if you're not an Apple user, you can leave a review right on the onebiteiseverything.com website. And secondly, make sure you subscribe to or follow this podcast wherever you're listening so you don't miss any of the amazing upcoming episodes released each Thursday. I'm your host, Dana DePrima, and this is One Bite is Everything, the podcast that helps you have a big impact on your health, the environment, your community, and our economy through tiny informed choices. Now, go eat some oysters, and don't forget the lime and the hot sauce, or the hazy beer.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.